This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Johannes Brahms was in his 40s before he could bring himself to finish a work he could confidently call a symphony. Brahms knew very well that most of the great composers who had preceded him had taken this crucial step while they were in their 20s or even younger. But he had spent the previous 20 years laboring under the weight of history, under the great expectations thrust upon him by his mentor, Robert Schumann, and under his own harsh self-criticism. When he finally did finish that first symphony, its enormous success gave him the energy, the freedom, and the confidence to transform what a symphony had become to what he felt it could be. By the time his fourth and final symphony had its premiere in 1885, Brahms was well established as one of Europe's leading composers, and the leading composer among those who embraced the traditional ideals of abstract music, as opposed to the music drama and tone poems of Wagner and Liszt. Brahms was also 52 and starting to think of retirement. That may be one reason the symphony's mood is so much darker than that of the first three, and why critics so often use the word autumnal when referring to it. The first movement of his G major string quintet from 1890 is thought to have been a sketch for a fifth symphony, but Brahms may have realized that with his fourth, he had gone as far as he could go in the genre that had taken him so long to conquer and of which he was now so clearly a master. The Fourth Symphony is not an easy work. It's not only a summation of Brahms' learning and technique, but a complex work of art that still manages to cut as close to the heart as music can. It's been called the quintessential Brahms work, the one he had been working toward his whole life and which displays his essence most completely. Form and function are balanced. Technique always serves expression, and expression is discovered through technique. If any of Brahms' music conveys a worldview, this is it. Listen to the first sighs in the strings. Both resigned and searching. A decade later, in the third of his four serious songs, Brahms would use a similar sigh for the words, O death, how bitter you are. The broad string phrases give way to a nervous figure in the winds before growing into a lament of deep yearning. This opening movement is all about the tension between the nervous and the keening, including an odd episode that sounds as though Brahms had entered the world of tango. With dance steps offering a staccato accompaniment to long, stretching lines. By the end of the movement, all this has changed. A chapter that began with music saturated in regret has taken on resolve. The broad, searching phrases of the opening bars are compressed into projectiles of energy, gathering momentum until they erupt in a cataclysmic climax. And a brief, unyielding conclusion. The opening movement was tragedy on an epic scale. The second movement is the response, offered in more human proportions. It begins with a horn call. introducing a tentative but steady melody that never ranges far from where it starts, still recovering from the upheaval in which the first movement ended. Eventually, Brahms finds the warmth in this theme. And the high strings enter to transform the tentative first steps into a flow of confident forward movement. This episode also ends in staccato bursts, but their energy dissipates quickly, giving way to one of Brahms's most expansive and luminous moments. Even when those staccato jabs return in a more tortured form, the answer is still the same. One last unsettled episode quietly rustles the autumn leaves. But the song returns us to calm after the stunned and anguished music that precedes it. The aggressively upbeat scherzo seems out of place, given what comes immediately before and after, like a slapstick episode in a great tragic romance. But we need some relief from the relentless seriousness of the first two movements, and Brahms delivers. The great keyboardist Rick Wakeman included a synthesized adaptation of this movement on the 1971 album Fragile by Yes. A joking scherzo it may be, but as it did in his life, Brahms's musical humor can have a crueler side. This jubilant music is followed by what, in 1885, was the most uncompromising, pessimistic conclusion ever heard in a symphony. In his first two symphonies, Brahms had followed Beethoven's model, ending each of those works with a positive statement. In his third symphony, he crafted something new, a finale of quiet resignation. Having found a way to shape a symphony into a genuinely personal statement, he went even farther in the fourth, farther than anyone since Beethoven, to music that was not simply personal and not simply contemporary, but music that looked into the future, toward a century that would validate his apprehensions. Thank you. The irony is that Brahms' vehicle for conveying this vision of the future was an ancient musical form. Brahms, the traditionalist, was fascinated with the music of Bach and Handel, and one of the forms he learned from them was the Passacaglia, a set of variations over a repeating bass pattern. One of his favorites was from Bach's Cantata No. 150, with a title that lends meaning to this movement of this symphony. Nach dir her verlanget mich, I long to be near you, Lord. Now, Brahms was more spiritual than religious, with no particular divinity in mind, but he had a strong sense of powers beyond the human. The eight chords that begin this finale form the foundation for 32 variations that define a world. The drama of the staccato jabs from the second movement returns. Along with a section that pays explicit tribute to Bach. After his earlier sets of variations on Handel, Haydn, Paganini, and Schumann, Brahms had become a master of the form. What this movement offers is a constantly evolving drama, one that wastes no time covering ground already explored, but that continues its explorations ever more deeply with each episode. The end comes almost before we know it is upon us, as it does in life. But for Brahms, what's important is the journey. And if we never know whether Brahms nears his Lord, whoever or whatever that might be, the answer is not important. The road to understanding is filled with detours and washed-out bridges, and we only hope we can negotiate the obstacles with grace. We may discard schedules and itineraries, but we don't quite abandon the conviction that one day we may arrive at our destination. And as we head there, we can be grateful for a traveling companion like Johannes Brahms. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.